It's that time of year again. The 2018 Atlantic hurricane season is underway. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the National Foundation for Transplants. Right now, hundreds of Tampa residents need an organ transplant they can't afford. You can join National Foundation for Transplants' Operation Second Chance at transplants.org to learn how to help give someone a second chance at life.
From the studios of WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sussingham. Hurricane season kicked off on June 1st, and scientists with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predict this year will be normal or above average, with up to four major hurricanes. Experts recently gathered at the National Tropical Weather Conference in South Padre Island, Texas, to talk about preparations for this season and lessons learned from last year's hurricanes, including Harvey, which slammed southern Texas with widespread flooding, Irma, which spurred the largest evacuation in U.S. history here in Florida, and Maria, which devastated Puerto Rico. Meteorologist Jeff Huffman with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network was at the conference. He sat down with veteran forecaster Max Mayfield, former director of the National Hurricane Center, who now works as a hurricane specialist for WPLG-TV in Miami.
For those who have never experienced a hurricane before, especially those who don't have much of an attention span or understanding of the impacts, if you had 8 or 10 seconds to tell them what to do, what would you say?
You can't do that. You can't do your hurricane plan based on an 8-second soundbite. You can't do that. And the reason for that is there are multiple hazards associated with a hurricane. There's a storm surge, the rain, the wind, the tornadoes. And you have to have a hurricane plan to account for all those hazards. And if you don't, any one of those hazards could kill you.
The messaging from the National Hurricane Center, from the time that you were there, the mission hasn't changed, but have your methods of messaging changed?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the technology is just amazing. I can't help but think, when I first came to the Hurricane Center, I didn't actually meet this gentleman, but they told me about him. He had recently retired from what had been the Weather Bureau back in the old days. His first job in the Weather Bureau was to fly a kite to take up-air observations. And by the time he retired, 35 years later, we had geostationary satellites. So in one lifetime of about 35 years, we went from kites to satellites. So I can't imagine what the next 35 years will hold. But it's going to be exciting. The technology is amazing. The first satellite image we got into the Hurricane Center, the old facsimile quality pictures, we had to put an acetate grid on there. I got there after they had received that, but they said it took them 8 hours to figure out what they were looking at. And now you've got satellite animation on your cell phone. I mean, how great is that?
Are we overcomplicating the message?
I don't think, well, some people may be, but the truth is we all have different roles. And the role of the forecasters at the Hurricane Center and the forecast offices are to make the best forecast they possibly can, right? The role of the emergency manager is to make those plans and call for the evacuations, open up shelters, reverse lane highways, all these other those things are very complicated. And then it's the role of us in the media to communicate those messages to people. And you don't, let's say, for example, you do not want a chief meteorologist or a TV anchor making the call for evacuations, do you?
No.
You want the emergency managers, the people who have written those emergency plans that know the timelines and know where the shelters are and know which shelters are going to be open in a particular hurricane. You want them to make those decisions. So it's a tremendous team effort. And I think we have come a long way. I mean, just looking at last year, any loss of life is regrettable. But in Irma, in Florida's case, that was a Category 4 hurricane. The core went through the lower Florida Keys. It moved up over the whole Florida Peninsula. And there were four direct deaths, only four direct deaths related to that hurricane.
In Florida.
In Florida, right. But we had 80 people who died indirectly. Electrocutions, carbon monoxide poisoning in improper use of generators, fires, people using candles when the power went out. Failure of medical equipment, and that we had this nursing home in Broward County that the power went out, the air conditioning stopped working, and they overheated. 14 people died, and there's a hospital right across the street. And you need to talk about that and educate people before the hurricane and before they lose power. That most of those indirect deaths, those are preventable with a little bit of common sense.
As former director of the National Hurricane Center, Max Mayfield, speaking with meteorologist Jeff Huffman with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Max Mayfield mentioned the 14 people who died in a sweltering South Florida nursing home in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma. Those deaths spurred the state legislature to pass new rules that require nursing homes and assisted living facilities to have backup generators. Though the rules went into effect June 1st, much of the industry is not in compliance. Florida Matters' Daylena Miller takes us to a St. Petersburg facility to see how they're making sure that vulnerable residents are safe in severe weather.
Dan Finn is in charge of the facilities at the Bon Secours St. Petersburg Health System. A big part of his job this time of year is making sure the 65,000 watt generator fires up.
This part this way is the generator itself, much like the generator on your car. This is what makes the electricity. This engine turns it. You know, and these are all the switches that do that.
Last year, during Hurricane Irma, he helped evacuate more than 300 residents. With the campus less than a mile from Tampa Bay, they felt evacuation was a better option. That same week in South Florida, another nursing home, one without a generator, saw 12 of its residents die when the air conditioning system failed, forcing them to live in sweltering conditions for 3 days. Soon after, Governor Rick Scott pushed for mandatory backup power at nursing homes and assisted living facilities. Kip Corriveau is an administrator at Bon Secours St. Petersburg. He says the mandate is short-sighted.
I kind of feel like with the governor's orders is you had one tragic event, and that was the face of disaster preparedness.
And it's proving tough for these facilities to carry out the order. The State Agency for Healthcare Administration reports that nearly 700 nursing homes and assisted living facilities have requested extensions to install backup power. There are nearly 3,800 of these facilities in Florida, and the state has threatened to fine those that aren't in compliance. The new rules also require facilities to keep enough fuel on hand to cool off a part of each facility for 96 hours. Corriveau says that's a big ask for some of the smaller facilities in Florida.
I think the great challenges are for facilities that are family-run, smaller facilities, 12-bed ALFs, 25-bed ALFs. I don't know where they find the resources to be reimbursed, because really none of this is reimbursable.
Corriveau says Bon Secours is lucky to be part of a healthcare system that can pay for expensive generators, including a second one they have to buy because of the new law. Their first one, which is the size of a small school bus, was $500,000, not including fuel and maintenance. But cost isn't the only problem. He says it takes time to get permits and order the equipment, not to mention everyone is trying to do it at the same time.
It's not that people don't want to comply. It's that people who run nursing homes don't build generators. They don't have factories. They are competing in a market with dozens of other folks in the same situation as they are with for engineers, suppliers, people to build the fuel tanks, do all this other kind of work. I mean, there's a limited pool of people.
Kristen Knapp is a spokeswoman for the Florida Healthcare Association, which represents most of the state's long-term care centers. She says the facilities she represents see generators as the first part of the solution to getting lights and air conditioners back on.
Hospitals get priority power. We'd like to see nursing homes just as important up at the forefront there when it comes to restoring power outages.
Kip Corriveau from Bon Secours can rattle off a long list of things they think about during storms.
The generator kind of issue is kind of low-hanging fruit. It's like a tangible thing that I get and I can understand, but there's so much more to this.
Like medical transportation, Corriveau says his residents were evacuated on school buses during Hurricane Irma. The buses were ill-equipped to handle the residents, who are frail and sometimes suffering from dementia. Generator rules are a good start, he says, but
we can make people do this and we can feel better and we think we've solved the problem and we haven't even begun to sort of deal with the complexity of the problem.
Corriveau says a solution needs to start at the local level with focus groups and better emergency management partnerships instead of with mandates from the top down. For Florida Matters, I'm Daylena Miller.
This is Florida Matters, and we're talking about the 2018 hurricane season. I'm Robin Sussingham. We'll be right back. I'm Robin Sessingham, and you're listening to Florida Matters. We're hearing from weather experts and listening to stories about how communities across Florida are preparing for this year's hurricane season. Jacksonville-based meteorologist Angie Inietti with the National Weather Service recently visited the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network's Weather Center at WUFT in Gainesville. A group of student journalists asked her for tips about how residents can prepare for storms.
For those living in north central Florida, what are the biggest inland hazards?
Definitely inland flooding, which can be a combination of river flooding and also freshwater flooding, which happens from just a lot of rainfall. And that's what we experienced during Irma here in the Gainesville area, and UF was the combination of river flooding and a lot of water not being able to drain out, and that's called inland flooding, as well as wind damage. So when you have a large storm, whether it be a tropical storm or a hurricane, acting with very strong winds over an area for a prolonged period of time, it causes a lot of trees to go down, it causes structural damage, and with those trees, we get the power lines down. So I would say definitely flooding, water, and winds.
So inland flooding being the biggest killer in hurricanes, what can people do to prevent becoming a statistic?
Well, I think what's really important is to first understand your flood risk, know your zone. And when we say know your zone, that means know your flood zone. And you can get that information by going to your county emergency management website, and you will learn what flood zone you are in. So first learn your personal flood threat. Then learn if your evacuation routes hit flood-prone areas, because you may need to consider another way to get out of the flood area that's at risk. So a relatively new product that the National Hurricane Center provides, and it's through their website, you can have access to it, are the storm surge inundation maps. And there's some different ways that you can reference these maps. They have probability of exceedance maps, like what's your percentage of your specific location seeing surge above a certain height. It's all about your personal risk level. You know, for your area and your home, you know, you might be 6 feet above flood level, and you're never going to flood your exact home, but perhaps access routes and evacuation routes getting near you might have a threshold of 3 feet, and they may become flooded. So looking at these storm surge maps and knowing your local risk as well as areas around you, that vulnerability is really important.
And kind of talking about getting ready for those storms, mm-hmm. What's the best way to prepare for a storm coming your way, given the fact that you're stuck at home?
Well, that's a really good question. It kind of leads us up to, a lot of folks are so focused this time of year. They start thinking, well, you know, what's our outlook look like this year? Are we going to have, a higher number of the storms than normal or a below number of storms? Every year, prepare as if it could be your year where we're impacted by a storm. So right now, if you're out shopping and happen to see a BOGO, like a buy one, get one free on soups or a buy one, get one free on a case of water, go ahead and get the extra one. Start stocking up now on goods and on things that are non-perishable, and just start stashing that away now in your hurricane supply kit. You know, extra towels, extra, start going through your documents at home and start, collecting a little file case of important documents that you can grab and go with you. Do that now. Because as you lead up to where we start hearing about a storm maybe impacting our area over the next week or so, that's going to be when a large number of people are starting to go get those supplies. And so at that point, you can start preparing on maybe helping ready your home to be impacted by the storm, because you've already stocked up on supplies. You've been gearing up for it for several months.
With pets and such, mm-hmm. how do you keep them safe and having a plan for a multitude of pets?
Well, that's a very good question. And in our area, we have everything from domestic animals inside to, livestock. You know, for the smaller animals, there are some pet-friendly shelters that if you need to go to a shelter, you can evacuate to, and it's good to look that information up beforehand. Most shelters, you will need a carrying case for your pet to go in there to keep them isolated and away from other animals. So that's something that you can look at getting now if you are going to take your pet with you. For livestock, there are resources that you can access through county emergency management websites on tips on how to keep your livestock as safe as possible during tropical events.
And so if you're not stuck at home, when's the time to figure out this plan?
Well, now's a great time to sit around the table with your family or even, with your roommate and say, hey, what are we going to do? If we have to make the decision to evacuate, Where are we going to go? When are we going to make that call? You don't want to make that call 12 hours before the storm is expected to be here, because you're going to get stuck in traffic, you know, a lot of other people. And it's not just the local area evacuating. I mean, for Irma, we had all of the Keys evacuating northward. Then you had South Florida evacuating northward. And that's all happening within a day or two of the storm impacting a local area. So you and your family need to make the plan now. You know, make your thresholds of, okay, where are we going to go? When are we going to make the call to evacuate? You know, 2 days out, 3 days out? Is everything going to go according to your plan? Absolutely not. You know, but at least you have a plan and a process that you're going to follow. You've already made an out-of-town contact saying, hey, Grandma, Grandpa, if we need to evacuate this season for a storm, is it okay if we come hang out with you for a weekend? So go ahead and kind of set that up now, because then when the time does come out, when we're 5-7 days out from a storm coming, you already have got something in place.
The past 2 years, Florida has experienced a few hurricanes, but that was after undergoing a dry spell. So do you feel that complacency is becoming a problem for some residents?
I do. So in 2016, we were impacted by Hurricane Matthew specifically, kind of, you know, skirted along the North Florida coast. And there were really significant effects along the immediate coast, including surge and wind damage. And we had some wind damage extending farther inland. But for the most part, Hurricane Matthew was a very close call. And I think it really opened folks' eyes up to, oh my gosh, you know, we can really be impacted here. So what was different for Irma in terms of what I observed folks preparing for is a couple weeks out from Irma even posing a local weather threat. Folks were monitoring, folks were paying attention. They were out at the stores getting groceries earlier than what was observed for Matthew, because I think Matthew was a real wake-up call. The impacts of Irma were much more widespread across our area. Irma came right at the middle part of the state, and it's still interesting to hear folks talking about Irma, because they still think locally across, you know, North Central Florida, Gainesville to Jacksonville, that we've been through a hurricane. And we haven't. We still have not felt the true impacts of a hurricane. Irma was still a tropical storm, or weakened to a tropical storm by the time it impacted our area. So, you know, we still want folks to take every season very seriously, prepare as if, you know, we're going to get impacted again by a storm, but the next storm could be stronger. We could see, you know, even worse impacts than what we had from both Matthew and Irma.
So trying to communicate that to the public, how important is it to properly communicate, and how can we as everyday citizens better understand the weather?
So that's a very good question. The National Hurricane Center and the National Weather Service, I mean, we're the team of, you know, meteorologists that analyze the data, and we put out all these forecast products and warnings. The key communicators are you guys and girls, our teammates in the field being the media. So I really think, and I think the Weather Service is kind of moving in this direction to try to help become better interpreters of what all this forecast gobbledygook verbiage actually means. Okay, well, we're going to expect a, you know, 5 to 10 inches of rain. Well, oh my gosh, that sounds a lot, but what's that actually going to do? Well, that's going to have Lake Alice overflow the banks and cause flooding on nearby roadways. It's going to have the Santa Fe River likely see, you know, record flood levels, which is what we had during Irma. So being able to take all that data and all those numbers and put it into terms that is tangible, is sensible to those receiving information, making it more real, I think is so important. And I know in the Weather Service, we're trying to go that route. You guys and girls in the media market have been doing that for years. So it's just keeping that close partnership between, you know, the scientists behind the camera and those that are in front.
That was National Weather Service meteorologist Angie Inyeti speaking with student journalists with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. And Yeti talked about stocking up on supplies, and that can be challenging for some residents of low-income communities. After Irma last year, there's a push in South Florida to help neighbors help each other if another major storm makes landfall. Reporter Kate Stein explains.
72 hours. 3 days.
Mark Moore oversees Miami's Emergency Operations Center, and 3 days' worth of supplies is what officials expect people to have on hand when a hurricane is coming. For people living on low or fixed incomes, 3 days' worth of supplies can be too much to afford.
A friend of mine on Facebook said, you know what, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Nancy Mater is a climate justice organizer with the New Florida Majority. The group advocates for lower income communities. A few days before Hurricane Irma hit, Mater was at a meeting telling other leaders what she heard from a friend.
It's the first of the month. I just paid all my bills and I do not have enough money to pay for gas or any hurricane materials that I need.
Valencia Gunder was there too. She's an activist, primarily in Miami's Liberty City neighborhood.
The communities that we care about are just going to be screwed over. Like, I'm just a sense of hopelessness just came over me.
The storm hit many lower-income communities hard, especially in the days after. People's non-perishable food ran low, and they couldn't afford to restock. And lines for emergency food stamps took 7 or 8 hours. With school closed, kids couldn't get reduced cost or free lunches. Seniors suffered through air conditioning outages that lasted 2 weeks.
I couldn't go down the steps because I live on the third floor. No electricity for the elevators.
Evangeline Gibson lives in a subsidized apartment in Overtown in Miami. Some relief came from volunteers, police, and a few commissioners dropping off ice or hosting free barbecues in parks.
I had a good neighbor that went downstairs and brought me up hot food and ice.
Less than a year later, support from neighbors is what community groups in Miami-Dade and Broward are trying to tap into to make lower-income communities more resilient against hurricanes. In Dade and Broward, there have been town halls and planning sessions to figure out places to store supplies and people to communicate important information before and after a storm. At a meeting in Brownsville in Miami, Valencia Gunder says she understands officials may have to prioritize getting roads and critical infrastructure up and running after a storm.
If I'm in my community and we have to wait 72 hours for whoever to come into our community to assist us, we can help one another until the help comes in.
Organizers say they're not trying to replace help from local governments. They still expect cities and counties to make hurricane plans that include people who are vulnerable. They want government officials in the conversation. Jane Gilbert is resilience officer for the City of Miami. She's in charge of connecting different city departments to work on all kinds of challenges. Gilbert was at the meeting in Brownsville. She says people who are connected with their neighbors tend to fare much better after disasters.
Because they do tend to check in on each other. And if they need help, whether it's getting food or ice or clearing out trees and debris or just making sure someone who's maybe physically more vulnerable is okay.
This idea of relying on neighbors is taking hold among South Florida leaders.
That's the first line of defense.
The Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact is a collaboration among governments, businesses, and nonprofits in Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade, and Monroe counties. They say when neighbors are connected to each other, that can help with issues from traffic to sea level rise to gun violence. In Miami, Jane Gilbert says the city is starting to think about how grassroots efforts might fit into official plans for hurricanes. Some other places have training courses for a new volunteer corps. They'll help out with things like cleaning up neighborhoods, first aid, and communications. In Monroe County, they'll get a special pass to get back in, right after a storm. I'm Kate Stein in Miami.
That sense of community spirit has been vital to residents of Everglades City in Southwest Florida. The tight-knit fishing village is still trying to piece itself back together more than 8 months after Irma. Reporter Rachel Iacovone spoke to one resident who was deeply affected by the storm.
We first met Jordan Mayberry a week after Hurricane Irma on the steps of her ruined home.
We just finished it exactly the way we wanted it. We just put up the fence, we just put in a new pool and the garage and the backsplash and the tiles, every single thing that you can walk in the house and see that's visible to the eye.
Mayberry and her husband worked paycheck to paycheck for 3 years to pay for the renovations to their dream home, only to have Irma's 10-foot storm surge wash it all away. The 31-year-old mother of two stood in her muddy yard, surrounded by pieces of her new fence, and said, despite everything, she was grateful.
We lost our homes, but we found humanity. Everglades City is a very close community.
Now, more than 8 months after the devastation, Mayberry says that community, that family, is how they've gotten through it. She says they're lucky that Everglades City has allowed its residents to live in trailers on their properties.
We are in our camper, and this is post-Irma. Our camper is placed in our backyard. I'm sorry. sometimes it's just hard to talk about.
The family of four is still in this camper because they're still waiting for their homeowner's insurance to settle, and they only got $1,500 from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Mayberry hangs her head at the small kitchen table in the trailer. Behind her, there's the sofa bed her 12 and 8-year-old daughters share. It's covered in stuffed animals. Mayberry says that's hardly a quarter of the girls' collection. The rest is in the garage with the refrigerator and washing machine and dryer. On the arms of the couch, which are now makeshift nightstands, the eldest has a collection of books, and the second grader has a pink cardboard castle she's constructed to hold her school supplies.
I'm crying, but they've actually been doing great. I think I worry about them more than I need to. You know, as a mom, like, you always just worry about your kids, but, I mean, they've been doing great in school.
She says it's at Everglades City School where, just after the hurricane and in the weeks that followed, the community rallied. Faculty and staff invited everyone in town to campus to grill burgers and hot dogs. Mayberry says one of her daughter's teachers even brought over cleaning supplies to try to salvage the house that had filled with water up to the electrical outlets. And with the supplies, she also brought a cooler full of sandwiches and cold drinks. The small act of kindness still brings tears to Mayberry's eyes, and she says it's one of the reasons her family never thought twice about staying after Irma.
You don't get that in a big town. You kind of get lost in, you know, the numbers, and people say, oh, you live out in Everglades City. Why would you want to live there? And I say, you can't explain it. You'd have to live it to know it.
FEMA spokesman John Mills put it this way last week. He said, perhaps just as important as preparing yourself for hurricane season is preparing your community. FEMA is often the last responders. It took the agency 5 days to get to Everglades City after Irma. 5 days of floodwaters and no electricity, cell service, or running water. Your neighbors are often the first responders, FEMA says, and that could not be more true of Everglades City, then and now. I'm Rachel Iacovone in Everglades City.
That's it for today's show. You'll find more of the conversation on our podcast, Florida Matters More. You can search for it on your phone's podcast app or on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. WUSF will keep you updated throughout this year's hurricane season with coverage of any storms that could affect our area. You can find the latest stories on our website, WUSFnews.org. You can always share your hurricane prep tips on our Facebook page or by tweeting at Florida Matters. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. The producer is Stephanie Colombini. I'm Robin Sessingham. Thanks for listening.